Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Today we look at the clash of spiritual worldviews in what might best be called America's religious wasteland, the Pacific Northwest. Known for a high proportion of unchurched individuals, the states of Oregon and Washington might seem to be an odd place to examine how two of America's larger religious subcultures, evangelical Christianity and mainline liberal Protestantism, go about their daily activities, including recruiting members, worshiping, and engaging the larger world around them. Indeed, most studies of these two distinct religious subcultures tend to focus on their respective geographic strongholds, the Southern Bible Belt for evangelicals, and the Northeast U.S. for liberal mainline Protestant denominations. But for today's guest, it was the relatively religious blank slate of the Pacific Northwest that proved to be the more intriguing environment to explore the differences and similarities between evangelicals and liberals. That scholar is James Wellman, associate professor and chair of the Comparative Religion Program at the University of Washington, and author of the recent book, Evangelical versus Liberal, The Clash of Christian Cultures in the Pacific Northwest, from Oxford University Press. That book will be the primary source of our discussion today. In addition to numerous published articles on contemporary American Christianity, Professor Wellman is also the author of another book entitled The Gold Coast Church and the Ghetto, Christ and Culture in Mainline Protestantism. We'll put up links to these books on our website so you can check them out for yourself. And it should also be noted that Jim practices what he preaches, or should I say studies, in that he is an ordained Presbyterian minister who is active with youth ministry in his church on Bainbridge Island. Jim, welcome to Research on Religion.
Great to see you, Tony.
Okay, now, on the past few episodes of our podcast, we have tended to focus on the economic and organizational aspects of religion, but today I thought it would be a good idea to give the sociologists their say and basically how they view how the religious world works, and in particular explore differences in worldviews between two relatively visible streams of American Christianity, that being evangelical and liberal mainline Christians. And moreover, we can do this in an environment wherein religion is supposed to not matter very much up here in Washington and Oregon. I should note that we are conducting this interview on the campus of the University of Washington, so we're right in the middle of your field work, I guess. So tell me, Jim, what motivated you to write about evangelicals and liberals in the Pacific Northwest?
You know, Tony, one of the things I did was I finished my PhD at Chicago, and the book, The Gold Coast Church in the Ghetto, was done on a church, a Protestant mainline megachurch in downtown Chicago. And it was a fascinating study, and when we came to the Pacific Northwest, came to the University of Washington, I thought the West Coast was a perfect place to continue that study of liberal Protestantism. And really thinking that the West Coast would be a mecca for liberal Protestants. And the truth of the matter is that when I received money to do that early study, I had a heck of a time trying to find vital liberal Protestant churches, in effect, anywhere on the West Coast. And eventually was able to get 12 churches in the study, and did a short article on that work. But in the midst of that study, is I came upon just really a plethora of evangelical, thriving, vital, growing evangelical congregations. And I naturally sort of began to put on my sociological hat and say, hey, let's do a comparison. You know, what makes these evangelical churches so vital and so growing in a place where you wouldn't think they would?
Yeah, it would seem that the Pacific Northwest culture would lend itself to very progressive mainline churches, but again, you find it's the evangelical churches that are really flourishing here.
For people who are listening to us who might not be in the Pacific Northwest, could you give us a little background of what Pacific Northwest culture is? Now, you grew up here, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and so I'm somewhat of an outsider growing up in the Midwest, spending time in California and coming up here, so it was a culture shift for me too. But give us an idea of what the general culture is, the non-religious culture is up here in the Northwest.
I think one of the misnomers about the Pacific Northwest is that it's liberal in the kind of communitarian sense that sometimes we find in the Midwest, when in fact I think it is much more libertarian. And that is, people come here in part to sort of develop their own entrepreneurial business interests and to get away from people. And the fact is that when you come across the Cascades, most people drop out most of their organizational affiliations and loyalties out the window. And, you know, that's been shown through survey research that that's just the case. And one of those organizational loyalties they don't have or they lose is any loyalty to a church.
Right.
And so you see in the Midwest, for instance, I think 60 to 65% people are affiliated with a church. In the Northwest, it's down to 35, 37%. That's a dramatic difference. And it's never been anything different. That is, when you go back in the history of this region, it's always been that way. And it's never really changed.
Yeah, that's the sense that I pick up from this, and it might help to explain why you have such a large unchurched population relative to other parts of the country. This is a place you escape to.
Exactly, and there's less people here. I think there's something like 10 people per square mile compared to the rest of the country is like 80 people per square mile. So you know, the subjectivity of being alone is real. I mean, it's empirically real in this region, and you just simply pick it up. And many people have said to me, having moved to the Pacific Northwest, they'll say something like, you know, no one ever asks me where I go to church. Whereas, you know, when they transferred from the South to the Midwest or even to the Northeast, people say, hey, where do you go to church?
That's the first question you get in places like Texas or Alabama or somewhere, right?
Exactly, and it's just taken for granted. Whereas here, it's not. And so... whether you go to church is certainly a choice. And as a sociologist, it's a fascinating, that's sort of why I said, it's an interesting place to study. Why do people choose to go to church in a place where there's no, absolutely no pressure? I think there's reverse pressure, pressure not to go to church.
I want to stick with the place to escape to, because I know I'm part of this, or some people would call part of the problem of people escaping from California and coming up here over the past two decades or so. And a number of sociologists have noted that, you know, people who are transient, meaning that they pick up from and move from place to place, really are not the churchy types. They're not the ones who've been rooted in their communities previously, and their rambling sort of life brings them to an area where they're not likely to set down roots and connect with a church, which is by many ways a hallmark of a community, usually communities organized around a church. Do you see this starting to change, though? It seems that our population is filling up and people are staying here longer. Is there any sense that this is changing that you can see?
You know, we don't really know. When you look at the survey data, it seems to me that the 1990s showed a revival of church religion in this region. And we don't know. We don't know over the last 10 years whether that's really continued or not. The people that go to evangelical churches, and those are the growing churches in this region, mostly come from evangelical backgrounds. So it's neither liberal or evangelical churches are gaining converts from agnostic types. They're more or less just moving what used to be liberals or evangelicals into their churches as they immigrate into the region. So it's a good question, but the other thing I would say about that is that I think you're right. People that come here are entrepreneurial types, and most of the businesses that thrive here are these boom and bust businesses, and a lot of people are attracted to that. And the economy has some downside consequences to it. But it's interesting because they come in part to get away from things, to escape, like you said, but they also want community. And mm-hmm. and so you see that too. So the what I think takes the place of community is sports organizations, especially for young children, youth. And one of the real challenges for ministry around this region is sports and community organizations don't cut church or religion any break. That is, for instance, on Bainbridge Island, lacrosse practice is on Sunday morning from a 9 to 11, literally in the morning, which is one of the biggest types of sports that Bainbridge kids play.
Right.
And that says a lot, that basically it's not a priority.
Right.
And it's not even thought of.
Yeah, oh, it's Sunday. Even, there's church then? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not even thought of.
Yeah.
So it makes, my sense too is that may be sort of the cutting edge of perhaps where we're going as a country. That is, religion is less and less taken for granted as a stabilizer, as a community builder, mm-hmm. as an anchor in a community.
Well, before we move on to religion, I want to just challenge you a little bit on your version of what the Pacific Northwest culture might be. I agree with you that there's this very strong libertarian streak, and I pick that up largely in Eastern Washington and Eastern Oregon. It seems the most visible. But what about downtown Seattle and downtown Portland? That seems to be your classic, more communal, old left type. I mean, I'm thinking about how Seattle was a, the Longshoremen Union and loggers and that kind of had that old kind of communal aspect to them. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I really kind of came into the study thinking the same way as you, mm-hmm. and feel like, especially when you think about Oregon, I think Oregon is deeply libertarian.
Yeah.
Even Portland. May not be relevant, but when you go to Portland, there are more strip joints in Portland than I think any city in the United States. At least this taxi cab driver told me this.
Yeah.
There's this libertarian spirit that anything goes. Now, maybe Seattle is a little bit different, but still, these public works and never really go very far in the state of Washington. You don't really see public education being supported, and we don't really have to go far to examine that. The University of Washington will be hurt by the budget crisis, but public schools, public transportation, and really hit and miss. In any event, my sense is Washingtonians really don't want to pay taxes,
mm-hmm.
and they might claim they're liberal, but a communitarian spirit, I don't think so. I'm more convinced by we have faux communitarian liberals, and most people, I think you're right about the Eastern Washington. Much more conservative, but even on the West.
Yeah, you might be right. Now that I think about it, is that Seattleites recently turned down a tax to support education that was going to be placed on their lattes and cappuccinos, and that just wasn't going to fly out here.
Exactly.
So let's turn to religion now. Your book, the main title is Evangelical versus Liberal, and that brings up these two distinct subcultures, which are broad-based categories, and there's many nuances underneath them that I'm sure we'll discuss. But could you give us the general characteristics of what makes an evangelical and a liberal in your research?
Yeah, it was interesting. If there was a critique of the book, is that some people didn't like those categories, and who wants to be labeled? And I don't blame them. But these were inductive labels that were created in part from the research, and that we're talking about a research about 450 interviews total, mm-hmm. individuals and focus groups. But in any event, liberals, I think, tended, and this is the tendency that we saw in all 10 churches, is that they this deep sense that Jesus was the one who has this inclusive hospitality, that everyone is accepted. And one of the most potent ways that was carried out in those churches was that I would say a third to maybe even a half of most of these congregations were gay and lesbian folks. And that was a strong sort of outreach for these churches, is to appeal to that portion of the culture. I think the other thing is they social justice, talking about social justice is a critical thing. And one, you know, kind of the chief sort of embodiment of that social justice was homeless ministries.
Mm-hmm.
And almost every liberal church had these homeless ministry sort of outreach going on. And we're very dedicated to that and very much appealing to tolerance, very much appealing to comparative. They wanted to learn about other religions so we could all be accepting and all loving of each other. So that was really the mark of the liberal churches in the study. The evangelical churches, on the other hand, you know, there were some real classic markers here, and that is, for the most part, almost every, all 24 churches believed in some form of infallibility or inerrancy for the scriptures. The scripture really was the key doctrine, or the key text that whereby everything was rationalized. Now, and just to kind of get back to liberals, now the Bible was taken seriously, but not literally in liberal churches. You certainly didn't have to appeal to it,
right,
to push whatever you were talking about. But in the evangelical churches, and I think the second thing with the evangelicals is that the importance of personal conversion to Jesus Christ, the acceptance of one as a sinner, the acceptance of Christ's forgiveness and his atonement, the importance of outreach to others, and this is a real interesting, and maybe we can talk more about this later, but the appeal to social service was a critical factor in these evangelical churches. And short-term mission, long-term missions were huge in these churches. And huge contrast to liberal churches in general, I found. And that was somewhat surprising. The other thing, in almost in every church, all 24 churches, small group ministry was a key.
Mm-hmm.
And really consistent throughout. And you didn't find that in the liberal churches. So, in you know, sort of a subcategory of small groups was family. And family, outreach to family, kids, children. And in a sense, they were creating family ministries in a sense to mirror what was going on in the youth and children culture secularly. In order to compete with that culture.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very dynamic churches.
Did you find any similarities between the churches, or anything that linked them in common at all?
Oh boy, that's a good question. Wow. Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to have to think about that. You know, I think there's a way in which they wouldn't recognize the other as a really legitimate form of the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of like walking in two different worlds, and the twain will not meet.
Right.
Although of course they're practicing the same faith in the sense that they get their image of Jesus from the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And from my own study, is you realize that you can get a lot of different things from the Bible and
right.
and different worldviews, and their worldviews are fairly they do contrast.
Do you see that? I mean, what you said there in terms of the similarities, they both view each other in somewhat the same ways. Do they seem to have a symbiotic relationship? Do they play off one another? Is there? Did you see in your discussions with individuals that, oh, well, we're an individual, or I joined the evangelical church because they're not the liberal social justice church, or vice versa?
Well, you know, that's a good question. they used to play off each other much more, I think, than they do now. And that's important in this sense. Evangelical churches, mainline churches, liberal churches, used to grow because evangelicals would get older, get more wealthy, and then transfer into mainline Protestant churches. And through survey research, we know this now. It used to happen about 21% rate of transfer. Now there is no transfer going on, and much less. That's in part the reason why liberal churches are declining. There's no bleeding from the liberal churches into the mainline churches anymore.
You mean from the evangelical
to the liberal? From the evangelical to the liberal churches. Having said that, liberal churches will often say, we're not like the fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll use fundamentalism in the worst possible sort of framework that you can. We're not like them. We're not homophobic. We're not exclusive. We're not small-minded.
We don't have big hair.
Yes, exactly.
That's a stereotype.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of like cliche stereotypes going back. Now, evangelicals, on the other hand, will barely mention the mainline Protestant church anymore.
That's interesting.
And if they mention it, it's sort of in terms like, they're sad. It's kind of sad for them. So the competition is no longer there for evangelicals, because they know their real competition is not the mainline liberal church. It's it's sort of the culture of no religion.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people they really have to try to appeal to and try to reach out to.
Yeah.
That's what they do. So it's it used to be more of a relationship, and but I think there's less and less, less and less relationship going on.
Well, let's go ahead and work our way through your book, and you do a number of nice chapters, 5 to be exact, where you really contrast the differences between the evangelical and the liberal churches and your findings with this with project. You said you did about 425 interviews or so?
Yeah, about 450.
And these are in-depth interviews, and I urge people to take a look at the book, because a number of the passages from these interviews are actually cited in the book, and they in many ways are extremely revealing about what is going on in these churches. The people basically speaking for themselves. But in terms of what you found out here, one of the first things that you look at was to look at their core allegiances and what you also call their moral logics. Now, what do you mean by moral logic, and how do these two distinct subcultures differ from one another?
You know, one of the things that I thought about with these groups is that their religion that they followed wasn't just instrumental. It was a core value and loyalty, and so I'm sort of pushing back against those people who simply thought these people were instrumentalist with their religion. They were using their religion for something more, something to get something. The power of these interviews was this was heartfelt, and whether it was liberal or evangelical, it was heartfelt. And so that's kind of what I meant by this core allegiance, is that for evangelicals, it was so clear that they were deeply, they would talk about it this way. They're in love with Jesus. And most of them would talk about their conversion experiences. And these conversion experiences were profound. I would say about a quarter of the 24 churches were more like Alcoholics Anonymous meetings.
In what way?
In this way, is that there was a core experience of sin, whether through drugs or alcohol or some other lifestyle aberration, and they would say, I came out of that, and Jesus was the answer. Many of those pastors had come out of very rough backgrounds, and I remember one in particular. He'd been in a car accident, a terrible car accident. He was a drug addicted guy. A young guy, kind of rough background, rough guy, and he said, "God, if I live through this car accident, I'll give my whole life to you. And this is what happened. He had a conversion experience. He lived through this terrible car accident, and he there he was, preaching the gospel. And I think in the same church, I'll never forget this story. This is a pretty good story. Is that so? He's preaching, and he's preaching to people who are not middle class types, not suburban. These are folks who have been through rough times,
right.
And that's who he appealed to. And at one point in one of the sermons, he said, this lady just stood up in the back, and she started flipping me off. And not just once, but I mean just putting her finger out the whole service. And this is the kind of guy who said, that's my kind of lady.
Mm-hmm.
And so after the sermon, he went up to her and said, hey, what's going on? And they had a talk, and he understood where she was coming from, and she converted to Christ and became a loyal member of the church. Now, so there's a way in which these churches were more rough. These were people who had gone through some tough times.
And I have to, you know, say that this is somewhat counterintuitive, that when you think of maybe the evangelical or fundamentalist churches, you tend to think of a very perfectionist type of individuals. But these people are coming out of, you know, very imperfect lives. And as you say, they're very vocal about their imperfections in that regard.
Well, and I think that's really a critical factor in what makes these churches really powerful agents of change for people, is that all the ministers I talk to would frequently talk about their own imperfections and their own, and be vulnerable with their congregations, even in the sermons. And in contrast to liberal churches, where you infrequently experience that kind of vulnerability. So there's a way in which I think the emotional impact of evangelical churches was very, very powerful. So their core allegiance was to this emotional experience of conversion. My life is completely different. And many, many stories of transformations where people really had given up their past lives and become new people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and you know, you have to be pretty hard-hearted not to say, hey, this was a good thing, because their past lives were pretty rough.
Right.
And not healthy,
yeah,
for anyone. But on the other liberal side of the core allegiance on the liberal side was also, may not have been emotional, or at least on the surface emotional. It was deeply held. In the sense that liberals felt their core allegiance was to who Jesus was as a human. And this Jesus they experienced was a Jesus who said, you will radically accept all people. And that allegiance to a kind of a moral vision of the beloved community, as Martin Luther King Jr. would talk about, or you know, as the great social justice, social gospel people would talk about. You know, so you came away with experiences where people were also transformed.
Mm-hmm.
And you were also moved, you know, as an observer. That I'll never forget in this one, the one focus group, for instance, you sat around a table, it was five people, and they were all, you know, gay or lesbian folks, who were talking about Jesus as any evangelical would talk about him, but were in a liberal church primarily because they felt their gay lifestyle had been accepted and they had been loved for who they were. And so that, and it was, you know, deeply felt transformative, of the effect of being accepted as for who they were, and that they could now live faithful lives of love and justice in the world. That's what they were trying to do. So in both those cases, so in both those cases, you're saying these aren't instrumental,
right,
situations. These are organic core allegiances that these folks had really chosen to be out of whatever situation they're in and be in a situation where they wanted to live lives that related to their religion. So, yeah, so that's what I meant by that.
Yeah. So how in terms of these core allegiances, and this leads us into the next chapter, yeah, I find a very smooth transition here, how do these core allegiances and these moral logics lead to differences in ideology and belief. Now, you make an argument that when we talk about ideology, you're talking mostly about secular ideology, the view, but you also understand that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to disentangle that from the religious worldview and the core allegiances that we were just talking about here. So,
yeah,
what about that?
No, you know, I think that's an interesting question. Is that especially for the evangelicals, that the experience of that individual transformation is so potent. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you look at the interviews, you're just going, whoa, again and again, these folks were saying, I had a moment where I just felt Christ's love, and it transformed me. And so there's what it does is, I think it transfers in this sense, in terms of ideology and its social effects, is they really strongly feel if the whole world can have that experience, then the whole world would be transformed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the critique, what that means in terms of a kind of a social ethic, they believe that their civic gospel is if people can be converted, then the world will change.
Right.
So they're fairly individualistic about social change. And on the other hand, the liberals will say, and this is really out of the social gospel movement, that if structures can be changed through political and social processes, then there'll be less inequality, there'll be less poverty, there'll be less social injustices. And so, you know, when those two folks try to talk to each other, it's like two people, you know, passing in the night. They don't have much in common, and that has big effects.
And you know, one can see that this is how a lot of our dialogue about religion and politics goes on, and we'll talk more on that here in a second. But the point that I pulled out of that chapter was that evangelicals see injecting religion into any policy debate as a primary first step and a necessary first step, whereas for the liberal churches, it, not necessarily. You don't have to put the religion in order to gain the social change in that regard. So is that a real
no? I think it's totally right, and that's important in the sense that. And I think, you know, liberals looking at evangelicals don't get this, is mm-hmm. evangelicals really don't care who the politician is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about the politician. It's about whether the politician is living out his or her faith in a way that transforms the situation for individuals. And so, whereas for liberals, on the other hand, the politician doesn't have to believe in Jesus if he or she is doing the right thing in terms of communitarian policies of helping the poor. Hey, that's what Christianity would say. That's what should be done. So loyalty to Jesus is not the critical issue, and they certainly wouldn't talk. They don't. Liberals do not talk religion in public.
Yeah.
Period. They just don't mention it.
Two separate worlds.
Yeah.
That's an interesting observation that you make, because when we think of evangelicals, we think of the Christian right, and we think of the tight link that they have with the Republican Party. But you said something interesting here. Maybe get your thoughts on this. Would be that you said that the evangelicals don't care about the party of the politician. They care about that personal conversion experience of the politician. So might it be the case that evangelicals are more likely to throw a Republican politician under the bus if they're not living the life or walking the walk, as compared to, as you say, with liberal mainline churches? They say, well, you know, if that person's not a believer, that's fine as long as they're following through with policies X, Y, and Z.
No, exactly, and you know, that's one of the things that really, really, you know, sort of changed my mind. In other words, I'll give you George W. Bush as an example of this, and that is when he said, you know, Jesus changed my heart. Remember that
right.
In that debate, that was a critical transformative moment. Because there's a sense in which, and the liberals are driven crazy by this, there's a sense in which as long as his heart is in the right place, whatever he does politically or policy-oriented doesn't matter that much. Now, what does matter, there's a couple exceptions on this. What does matter is probably two things. One, he can't support abortion. Mm-hmm. Choice. And two...
And this is for the evangelical.
Yeah, right. This is for evangelicals. Two, he has to believe in family and not really support gay or lesbian rights, or certainly not gay marriage. Those are... Now, so in other words, a politician can believe in Jesus, can do everything right in terms of what evangelicals believe in, but if they're wrong on abortion and the gay marriage issue, they're thrown over. Mm-hmm. So there are some policy decisions that are a kind of tipping point for them.
Mm-hmm. A litmus test.
Litmus test.
but it seems more that they're focused more on the personal behavior of the individual. I mean, I see how, you know, if you fall. There's recently a congressional representative of Indiana came out announcing that he has marital infidelity problems, and you could just see the evangelical support just dry up from him. And being Indiana is actually a fairly big evangelical state.
Exactly.
So I can see where that is the case. Whereas, you know, with the liberal mainline churches, they might be much more forgiving of that.
Oh, totally. And that's the you know, President Clinton is the perfect example. Mm-hmm. Is the when he had this infidelity. Liberals would often say, "Well, it's just a private matter. What's wrong with these people?" Mm-hmm. And evangelicals would say, "Oh, it's over. We can't support him in any way."
Let me ask a tough question. Get your thoughts on this as well. With in terms of the, you know, we were just talking about the core allegiances of the liberal mainline church, and then you also noted that liberal mainline folks are much less likely to talk about their religion in public. I mean, if their deeply held, you know, spiritual beliefs about the social gospel, the beatitudes, so to speak, is very important, why are they willing to hide that? Why not bring that out and say, this really informs my worldview, and this is why we're doing it, blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, etc.? And why the reluctance there? Why not share?
Well, I think, you know, they come out of a secular educational mm-hmm. system that says, you know, puts this kind of post-colonial guilt on them. And you really hear that, see that, hear that talked about a lot. So any kind of public persuasion that uses religion is almost a taboo. Mm-hmm. And I think it really comes out of that critique. Of when religion is taken into the public square, it is almost always wrong. Mm-hmm. And thus, to even talk about it is a sign of intolerance.
Right.
You know, and that really hinders the political witness of liberals in general. They are really kind of hogtied by this, you know, to some extent guilt, to some extent... this sense of taboo that, you know, they simply can't talk about their faith in a public forum. Mm-hmm. So,
and then one of the exceptions to that, and you mentioned this in the book, might be Jim Wallis of Sojourners, or does he have that same tendency as well, do you think?
Jim Wallis is an interesting character. Yeah. Because he calls himself an evangelical, but we know through this 450 interviews no evangelicals read his works.
Right, right.
And so I think, and then liberals invite him to their church. They like his politics, but they would prefer him to stop talking about his faith so much.
Yeah.
So I don't think he's an exception. I think he's just, his politics are right, but they wish he'd shut up about his faith so much.
I see. Okay. That's kind of interesting. I mean, I guess we talked here a little bit about, you know, what you were talking about in Chapter 9 about the how liberals and evangelicals differ politically. Actually, one question I have, in going back before we talk about the organizational aspects, which are two chapters I found relatively interesting is the demographics of these groups in your interviews. Were there any differences? You had mentioned that some of these evangelicals would, as they got older, would fall into the mainline category, but they don't seem to be doing that anymore. And what do you notice any differences demographically between these groups? Is there a rural-urban divide, age divide, gender? What are you seeing?
Well, evangelicals are younger. The interviews, there were many more males in the evangelical churches than I think there's a fairly even gender ratio in the evangelical churches, which is compared to liberal churches of 65, 35,
right,
in terms of female and male. Younger, family-oriented, many more kids in the evangelical congregations. Evangelicals in terms of their kind of educational levels have increased fairly dramatically, and their income levels have gone up. So there's a lot less reason to, at least kind of socioeconomically, to go to a mainline church anymore.
Yeah, that's one thing that was very interesting in your work here that you mentioned was the socioeconomic characteristics of these evangelicals. We tend to think about them as being the poor Southerners, that these are poor churches, but that's not the case up here. That they're very middle and upper class in that regard. And you talked about this in relation a little bit to the social, or not the social gospel, but the prosperity gospel seems to be a big draw for a number of these churches. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was interesting. One of the, about eight of the 24 evangelical churches were Pentecostal, charismatic, and in several of these congregations, the other factor here is demographically, ethnic integration, much higher in evangelical churches. And in particular, in this one Pentecostal church, both ethnic, larger ethnic pool that was really, that was a part of their mission is to create a sort of more diverse community of in terms of ethnicity. But they also had a strong prosperity gospel. This great example, I love this example, is this one African-American young woman, just a beautiful, brilliant young person who had applied to Harvard, Yale, gotten into all these Ivy League schools, wanted to go pre-med, was accepted. She said, no, I came to the University of Washington because God has called me here as a part of my ministry. I'll do pre-med here, but I'll do it here because my ministry is here. Mm-hmm. And so she was talking about that real transformative, she was called to be here. And she also said, and this is really interesting, is that she really believed in the prosperity gospel.
Mm-hmm.
As she would say, and I think this is a quote, she said, my father, who's her earthly father, she said, would give me anything, would do anything for me. And she said, my heavenly father would even do more.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever I ask, he has promised to give. And so for her, that meant give in every way. So, mm-hmm. In terms of, I think, blessings in this world, etc. But, there's a tendency from the outside to look down upon that and say, this is all materialism. But these people were doing extraordinary things with their lives.
Right.
I mean, she wanted to be a doctor, to be a missionary.
Yeah.
And these were very smart, bright, really articulate young people. Mm-hmm. And it was a pleasure to be with them.
For the folks that might not know what the prosperity gospel is, it has this sense of the more you give to your faith, the more the Lord will bless you, and materialistically is really the object of it. And again, you're right that many people have taken a very cynical read on this, that we might see our televangelist on there in their big compounds and fancy clothes and such, and think, well, this is just kind of a material gig to just make more money, and this is if it's not Amway, then it's going to be Pentecostalism. But as you're finding out, that the heartfelt conviction behind a lot of these people, that first step really is that faith conversion, not so much, well, I'm going to get rich by becoming a faith conversion, is that I understand my faith first and then the material wealth comes afterwards.
I mean, I think if you read Rick Warren's book, Purpose Driven Life, you know, and I went over that very carefully, and that he has chapters where, you know, and a lot of liberals will be cynical about this, but he basically says, for the wealthy in his congregation, I want you to get together and talk about how to give away your money, not all of it, but to give away your money in such a way that it blesses the kingdom of God in this world. Mm-hmm. And so they're very aggressive about how to use your material gains for the sake of the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Warren has tried to do a lot for Africa and other places in the world.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're kind of talking about the organizational aspects of the church now. As you talk about Rick Warren, who's written not only the Purpose-Driven Life, but the Purpose-Driven Church, of how these different churches really organize their activities based upon their core allegiances. Now, what are the differences between the evangelical churches who, you know, have this prosperity gospel ideas, who have, personal conversion, versus the liberal mainline churches? What organizational impacts do these different worldviews have?
Huge impacts. The evangelicals were by far much more entrepreneurial, much more ambitious about their churches. They literally would look at a town, let's say a 55,000 person town, and they say, we want every person in this town to be a Christian, to be a part of a church. Then they would go about trying to make that happen. And so many, many times their mission statements were statements like, our mission is to make every Kitsap County man, woman, and child a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas liberals wouldn't even begin to think about being ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't even think about, you know, conversion of those who are not already Christians. So organizationally, it means a great deal. Organizationally, for instance, the 24 churches in our study, evangelical churches, had grown by 100% on average over 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So basically doubling in size.
Mm-hmm.
And often they would say, for instance, we're going to build a whole new Christian education building, even if we don't have the kids right now. We're going to build it because we want to fill it.
Mm-hmm.
With new people. And so, you know, if you build it, they will come. That was their motto. And you know, it was exciting to frankly be around them because they were so upbeat and so visionary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another critical part of this is leadership. By far, the leaders in these churches were more skilled, you know, in terms of their organizational styles, their get up and go, their initiative, their sense of strategic planning, their willingness to take risks, their willingness to fail, their willingness to succeed.
And, mm-hmm.
you know, just in almost every way, that was an extraordinary difference. The other thing that, and a lot of liberals don't understand this, is that the evangelical churches, the worship services,
mm-hmm.
a lot of liberals think, well, these evangelicals, they just get in and they talk about sin and it's depressing and, you know, gloom, doom, they're going to hell. Well, no, these churches were alive and lively and friendly and happy.
A lot of music, a lot of contemporary music. Yeah.
Totally, and great music. And so, you know, it was much more fun to, frankly, go to the evangelical churches than the liberal mm-hmm. churches because they were so alive.
Yeah, which might be true. Did you find that a lot of liberal mainline churches are sticking with the old hymnals and the organ music?
Well, they're trying some new things. But, you know, for instance, I sent a class at the University of Washington. I sent a class to what I called a liberal and an evangelical churches, right? Mm-hmm. Just check it out. Do a little study, a little case study on you know, American religion. What do they come back and say? Well, they'll call the liberal church conservative. Why? Aesthetically, it's conservative. It's traditional music, kind of dull. They'll say stuff like this. Why do those people go to the church?
it probably has an old, musty church smell to
totally.
It. Right?
Totally. And then when they go to the evangelical church, they'll say, wow, really fun.
Yeah.
Really great. Now, these are kids who are mostly secular, mostly liberal, ideologically. They'll say, this is a quote from one of the students, "I loved everything about it, but I disagreed with every word the pastor said."
Wow.
So, you know, it was a bit of hysterical. But, you know, that's the truth.
Yeah.
That's their experience.
If they draw you into that. In terms of the churches that you visit, I guess this is one of the interesting things that I've noticed here, too, with a lot of the evangelical churches popping up, that they're not your typical church building. These are built in warehouses, or I know one of Mars Hill's churches was built in a former carpet store, a bowling alley or something along that line, and it doesn't have that old churchy steeple look to it.
Yeah, totally, and I think, you know, that's a piece of it, is that they want to appeal aesthetically to the secular person, and that's in part what they do.
And in terms of, just to step back a minute, you talked about how the leadership of the evangelical churches was much more younger and energetic. Do you know, was there any difference in terms of their training? Were they trained differently? Were they trained less? What?
Oh, you know, I think they would say they get New Testament training. That is, they get a mentor.
Yeah.
You know, a young person is raised in their church. He is identified as someone of talent and maybe a calling, and so he's called. And then he's mentored by an older pastor to be, you know, minister of the gospel. And so he's not sent off to Princeton or somewhere, Yale, to study for the seminary. He's nurtured in the congregation. Now he can be sent out to then, you know, start a new church. But I think evangelicals are very smart organizationally. They're just, they understand entrepreneurial methods, strategies, and they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're successful.
Also, in terms of the mission pastoral outreach programs, how do churches differ in that regard as well?
Well, one of the real surprising findings of the study, Tony, was that in terms of actual social service, both locally and internationally, evangelicals were doing much, much more. There's a reason why that doesn't show up publicly, or people don't have a sense that evangelical is doing much outreach, because most of the outreach done by local congregations in terms of service to their community is all through informal networks. Mm-hmm. In other words, five men would say, "Hey, let's start a little painting business for the older folks in the community." And then they would just go do it. They wouldn't wait for Habitat. They wouldn't start a nonprofit. They would just go do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now this, and what I found was, evangelicals were doing this left and right, but no one knows about it because, you know, they simply aren't picked up by secular organizations. That was really a huge difference. On the other side, liberals tended to be older congregations and tended to be active only through kind of formal nonprofit community or service organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of that was through Habitat or through the homeless ministries. In general, what I found is that evangelicals were doing really much more social service. And I'm not talking about evangelism. Mm-hmm. I'm really talking about social service. You know, giving to the poor, helping people with their housing, painting.
Yeah, that I found to be very interesting. And I think that's one of these things that's not picked up very well in a lot of our studies of how churches benefit communities around there. I mean, you can think of, you know, a homeless shelter, Union Gospel Mission is very visible, and you can easily count that. But it seems, you know, from the story that you're telling, that a lot of these evangelical churches pick up and do an activity. It might not necessarily continue through with that. They might morph into something else or find somewhere else to drive their energies in that regard.
Yeah, you know, one of the really untold story, maybe unstudied stories, is that invisible care, simple acts of courtesy, hospitality, service to the other. I think it's dramatic. And I kind of joke about this. I say, you know, liberals say sometimes, you know, academics say, "Hey, just get rid of these churches." Okay, get rid of these churches, and we'll see what these communities look like
mm-hmm.
afterwards. And I think there would be devastation. because I think there's a lot of service that goes on that's invisible.
Yeah.
And unless you talk to people, as we did, literally, hear what they're doing, you know, it was really extraordinary. And you know, we documented it. It wasn't, you know, this wasn't just a, you know, my opinion or my feelings. It was, we documented their service, and it was with a lot going on.
Yeah, and I find that to be in something interesting that I saw in the book, and you know, it goes many ways to one of the stereotypes of conservative evangelical Christians that, well, you know, they're only concerned about themselves. I mean, I guess this comes from their, you know, emphasis on the personal conversion part. It seems to be a me, myself, and I type of religion. Mm-hmm. But in reality, and Arthur Brooks has written about this, is that you find that a number of these evangelicals tend to be very giving in ways that you don't see, in ways that are not triumphant at all. And I think you're right. This is a very understudied aspect of the religious landscape. And I mean, one of the things we try to do here in Research on Religion is suggest avenues of research for graduate students or other faculty members to look into. And I think you just suggested a great title for a book, Invisible Care.
Yeah, no, I thought a lot about that. Yeah,
so that's a good idea. We'll kind of finish up here talking about the relative growth and decline of these two denominations. Now, you know, in your study, you actually looked for, you know, vibrant, flourishing liberal mainline denominations, and that was part of it. But, you know, you noted at the beginning of the book that, you know, in your search for this, that you had to struggle to find some of these growing mainline churches and general surveys of the religious landscape here in the United States show that liberal churches are not growing at the rate that these evangelical churches are. What did you pull from your study on why this might be the case?
Well, you know, I just wrote a little article for Pathos on who's the real mainline. Mm-hmm. And clearly, you know, it's 25-30% of Americans are evangelicals now, and they are the mainline Protestant now. And they're, you know, maybe they're not organizationally united as the once vaunted Protestant mainline was.
Right.
But, you know, when you really look at Protestant mainline, their decline is continuing. The ELCA just allowed the ordination of gay and lesbian folks, and frankly, I'm for that. But we know from studies that, you know, this will mean probably the loss of another one-fifth of their membership.
Right.
Now, liberals will say, well, that's worth it because that's about what justice does.
And,
but so the real facts of the case are is that liberals really believe in their message. It's not like this is a false state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really believe that justice is the key. And it's just the facts is that they don't know how to reproduce themselves.
Yeah.
And to some extent, they don't care to. When you ask a liberal church or a liberal pastor, do you want to double the size of your church? No. Almost everyone will say, no, I do not.
Yeah.
Do you want to convert the children in your congregation? Probably not.
Yeah.
And so, you know, do I think that's a loss? I think that's a loss. I think there's something really good and something beautiful about the liberal Protestant church in general. Organizationally, do they understand how to reproduce themselves? Not one bit. When you talk to denominational leaders of seminaries, for instance,
mm-hmm.
I think seminaries are basically leading the charge towards decline.
Yeah.
Why? Because they think that the right theology will attract people.
Well, that brings up a point, and you put your finger on this at a number of points in the book, and I don't know how much you explore it in there, but this issue of schisms within liberal mainline churches, that there's this evangelical versus liberal tension that you notice between the well-defined congregations, mm-hmm. but even within liberal denominations, there this tension seems to be alive, and we see that with the, you know, the Episcopal Church is facing a major schism. It's going through the Presbyterians, and the Methodists have faced theirs at numerous points in time. So, I mean, might that attitude that you're talking about, that, well, we'll just get the right theology and everybody will follow us, might not be the path that many people in the congregation are thinking they should be going?
You know, I agree with you. I think seminaries are thinking or are trying to argue that we have the right theology and thus everything will take care of itself. And it's one of the strangest death wishes I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I was talking to the president of the Presbyterian denomination, the mainline Protestant PCUSA church, and I said, they asked me, what would I do? What would one thing I would do? I said, well, go hire a bunch of really young, bright, dynamic young people, young adults, men and women, pay them good money, and let them go out and start youth ministries and family ministries to start churches. And make sure they're, somewhat extroverts, that they're not introverts, and that they really care about their faith and they want to reproduce it. And I just got a blank stare. Now, and then asking another woman who was in charge of theological education in the Presbyterian Church, I said, what are most seminarians like in terms of their kind of personalities? And she said, they're mostly introverts and they're mostly interested in academics.
Yeah, deep theology.
And then I said to myself, there, that's it. It's over. Yeah. I mean, I'm not against being introverted. I'm not against academics and the study of theology. But if that's what you're banking on to grow a church, your investment's being wasted. And we know now that these seminaries will outlive the reproduction of the churches they're trying to support.
Right, which is...
it's the strangest thing.
A great irony to it, yeah.
Yeah, so... So, I mean, I don't mean to be doom and gloom, but all the indicators are pointing in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Let me ask, just a final observation, and this is, I was thinking about this throughout your book, because the book is wonderful in that it really explores what is going on in these two distinct subcultures in ways that, it explode stereotypes on both sides of the equation here. But I kept thinking about this and thinking about my colleagues around here at University of Washington and throughout the country that are at major state universities that just still cling to some of these old stereotypes and really don't understand, in many cases, don't even understand why I'm studying religion in the political science department. When I first got here, somebody advised me, the religion dissertation is really nice, but you should move on to something because, didn't you read Nietzsche, God is Dead? And, okay. Do you think scholars are getting this and, really have a sense of what religion is?
Well, we know that in terms of kind of the academic world, religion is being taught more and more people are going into the study of religion.
Just as a side note, my colleagues were stunned when I, with your help actually, set up a specific numbered course on religion and politics, and they had initially scheduled me for 50 seats, thinking nobody would show up, and within a matter of 2 years, there's now 250 people, and I'm still turning people away. The demand for it is huge among students.
No, and it's funny because I'm thinking about starting a 100 level course on, just say, God 101.
Right.
And basically, do a little bit of Karen Armstrong work and say, the study of humans through the construction of the gods they've created, which would be, really fun and I think of interest to a lot of kids. But kind of getting back to your question, I'm a religious person and been religious all my life. And even I suppose, when I went to these evangelical, I had my own stereotypes and my own biases. And they were really exploited in my interaction with them. And what I found is that these folks are deeply committed and loyal to their religion. And it has all sorts of social and political effects. Mm-hmm. And so to underestimate that is, I think, a mistake. And we see that with 9/11. We know the Islamic world, okay? I mean, Juan Cole's recent book on that basically said that Muslims feel very strongly about the importance of their faith in their lives, even more so than parts of America like the South.
Right.
Higher levels of of survey research shows that they feel strongly about it. So the strength of religion is maybe diminishing in academies, but it's certainly, I think you can argue that it's growing elsewhere. And will it ever go away? No. And do you need to understand where that strength and that interest comes from to be able to understand it well and to study it well? Yeah, I think so. Do you have to be religious to really understand it? No. But to go into it thinking, I'm going to go prove that religion is meaningless or that secularity is just right around the corner, I think is also a kind of bias that's a mistake.
Yeah.
So, you know, I that's kind of where I come from.
And I think that's a bias that can be corrected with your book, Evangelical versus Liberal, The Clash of Christian Cultures in the Pacific Northwest. And even though it's a book specifically about the Pacific Northwest, or your research was done there, it really speaks to the wider religious divides that we see throughout the United States and I think, you know, generally throughout the world in many parts. And I think many of scholars as well as lay individuals would do well by picking up this book and taking a look at it. So, Jim, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion, and we hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you, Tony. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.